Okay, we ready?
Yep, all yours, Andy.
All right, thanks. I want to thank all of you guys for joining us at this point. I'm going to try to keep the amount of talking I do. Is everybody okay over there? I'm going to try to keep the amount of talking I do to it so that we can get as much discussion as possible. And I'm assuming that most of you are pretty familiar with the process that we're in the midst of right now, but I want to just give a little bit of background about what's happened prior to this web conference for those of you who have been a little bit less involved. And at any point, if somebody wants to interrupt me as I'm going, please feel free to use the hand raise feature. I'm going to go pretty quickly, but I also don't want to leave anyone in the dust, so I'm happy to be interrupted. The Surface Dynamics community of practice got its start about a year ago in January when a bunch of us, mostly who have been involved in the old land atmosphere ice interactions group, but some other folks as well, got together in Seattle to start thinking about what the next step as far as terrestrial Arctic research was, and we, as you'll see, expanded beyond that quite a bit in our thinking. So we began this process last January, and at the end of the meeting in Seattle, a group of about six of us, I believe, were nominated or coerced in some fashion into being a steering committee of sorts to do some thinking in small groups to try to advance this. And I think some of those folks are with us today. It's Josh Schimmel, Heidi Stelzer, Mary Beth was nominated in absentia, Craig Fleener, Craig Gerlach, and I know I'm forgetting other people. Who else? Anybody else out there who was in that group?
Lillian, but she's
Lily,
here.
That's right. Lil's in, over in Australia. So this small group of us worked in fits and starts over the last year or so to get together the draft priorities document that hopefully at least some of you have gotten a chance to look at. We finally got that together this fall and really have just begun to solicit input on it. So we're still very early in the process of defining these science priorities, but hope to be able to move quickly from here to get some ideas to the ARCS committee. So the notion is that we are a vehicle for moving ideas from the grassroots up to the ARCS committee, and from there those ideas will hopefully inform science planning for the next phase of collaborative Arctic research. The model that we're operating on is not the old-fashioned one where we would get together and produce a really, really, really long, glossy science plan, but a more streamlined one where our goal is going to be to produce a rather brief, something on the order of 5-page prospectus that describes our science priorities and that provides the ARCS committee some justification for why we think these are the really crucial things to look at. So we're looking at producing some document that is far broader than an individual proposal would be, but is far less vast than some of the science plans of yore. So we're really trying to define what we think the central priorities are without getting too far down the road of thinking about how to achieve them. So this is the key phase where we're hoping to get ideas, and as I said, I'm going to go through fairly quickly what the thinking has been so far and hopefully dive into getting a lot of feedback from people. So Laura, or whoever's doing slides, can we go – actually, no, stay at the slide for a sec. What I'm going to do is just give you a little bit of background as far as the brainstorming that we went through about Arctic surface change, then briefly highlight the components of the science priorities document as it exists right now, the science questions, what we think the key variables are, and then I'm going to end with the questions that I want to ask of you folks. Okay, so now, Laura, if we could go to the next slide.
Okay, this is it.
I'm sure that most of the people who are online or on the telephone are aware of everything I'm about to say, but one of the way we started this process was by sitting around a table and thinking about what we know about the Arctic and what that points us to in terms of future directions, and where we came to the idea of a collective surface dynamics group that's looking simultaneously at ocean and land surface change was from the following observations that I suspect will be familiar to many of you. Regardless of where you look on the Arctic surface, we were able to very easily think of examples of rapid change. So the graphic that you're looking at if you're online is a figure from the National Snow and Ice Data Center through September of 2005 showing a steep decline in summer sea ice. Next slide, Laura. Similar patterns show up on land as well. This is just a graphic from a couple years ago from an analysis of land ice, of reductions in glacial ice. The brownish line that you see, the more smooth curve, is cumulative thickness change over time, showing a rather marked reduction in land ice. There's similar data showing fairly marked increases in the temperature, permafrost, thawing of permafrost within the discontinuous permafrost zone. So the Arctic surface as a frozen surface is certainly changing in a number of different dimensions. Next slide. And we've seen from the past land atmosphere ice interactions work and all sorts of other work, fairly pronounced changes in the vegetation of the Arctic land surface. The expansion of tall woody vegetation has gotten a lot of press, both in terms of forest vegetation moving into the tundra, like you see in the photo on the lower left. Matthew Sturm has his repeat photography data showing on the right the expansion between 1949 and 2000 of those dark clumps of shrubs. Skip has pointed out to me that there's equally compelling changes going on outside of the zone of woody vegetation. So fairly marked transformations of the Arctic surface in terms of vegetation. And then next slide. And then the thing that I think we spend perhaps within the Arctic climate change community a little bit less time thinking about, but certainly came up at our Seattle meeting, is the expansion of industrial development. So the figures that you're looking at are both from the Globio project report, which came out in 2001, which, if you're not familiar with it, essentially what they did was to use the literature to define ecological impact zones of different components of human infrastructure, so roads and settlements of different kinds, and then produced a map around the world. This is just showing you the Arctic, of the impact zones of areas that are heavily impacted by human activity. And so the red areas on that map are areas that are within the impact zone of human infrastructure. And you can see that there are large areas of the Arctic that, as we all like to say, are relatively undisturbed by human activity, but you can also see some rather substantial areas of red indicating that there are large areas of the Arctic and areas that are increasing that are directly affected by industrial development. The graphic over to the left on this slide is simply showing the kinds of data that led to the production of that map that you can show, for example, this graph shows caribou, wolf, bear, and elk, that for all of those species, measures of the organism's success, either breeding success or abundance, tends to decline as road density increases. So there are some direct effects of industrial development that we perhaps haven't looked at, particularly in the past, but that are certainly a component of this collective Arctic surface change. Next slide. So the overall goal, after we sat around and thought about all of those things, what we came up with as an overall goal for this community of practice was to understand the cumulative and the interactive effects of land and ocean surface transformation on the future state of the Arctic system and on its residents. So this notion that there is really ubiquitous surface change affecting both the land and the ocean was striking to us. And although I think we originally were a community of primarily terrestrial ecologists, although not exclusively, we began to be quite interested in the notion that the Arctic surface is changing, whether you're on land or on water, and that perhaps looking in some holistic fashion at those simultaneous changes might be a worthwhile endeavor. So what we came up with in terms of key science questions, these are really sort of the overarching questions that are driving this, the largest scale questions. The first is a question about rates and trajectories of Earth surface change, so thinking about how these changes that have been observed over the past decades may proceed in the future, what the nonlinearities and the thresholds may be that govern those rates and trajectories. And as part of that, thinking about feedbacks between the ocean and the land surface and with the rest of the Arctic system that may alter those rates and trajectories. The second question, larger, broader question we came up with has to do with the relative roles of climate and human activities as drivers of Earth surface change. And we've primarily, as a community, I think, thought about climate as a driver of surface change, both on land and in the ocean, but we heard some compelling voices at various points in this planning process, and there are certainly some compelling data to back this up, suggesting that industrial development and direct human activities in the Arctic are also a potentially important and progressively more important driver of Earth surface change that we ought to throw into the mix here. And then the third question was really an impacts question that has to do with how this simultaneous surface change on both land and in ocean may interact with other forces of global change to affect human populations and or resource development. So, Laura, if you can go to the next slide. The way to really think of these science questions is that they cover three categories of things we are interested in. The first has to do with predicting future trajectories. The second has to do with what the drivers of surface change are in terms of the relative roles of climate and other forms of human activity. And then the third is an impacts question that asks why this all matters for people both in and outside the Arctic. So next slide. We we came to this notion of looking at land and ocean surface change a little bit late in the meeting we had last January. And so I wanted to throw a few ideas to you about why we thought looking at collective Earth surface change might be important as opposed to just looking at land surface change. And I think that the question of how broadly we define ourselves is one that would be worthy of some discussion later, because I know there's many schools of thought on this, but I'll tell you what our thought presses were up to this point. There are really three categories of factors that led us to think that this more collective look at land and ocean surface change might be worthy. The first is that in our simple thinking through of this, it struck us that changes in the land and in the ocean surface have very similar effects on humans. Both have profound effects on transportation. The melting of permafrost, the loss of sea ice, both have really extraordinary effects on the ease of transportation in the Arctic. Both affect access to food resources by altering marine and terrestrial food webs. So there seemed to be a similarity in impacts that argued for looking collectively at these changes. The second thing that we came to is that in many cases you can come up with examples of how the impacts of changes in one domain on land or on the ocean may depend on the other. And probably the clearest example that we could think of is that if you were trying to imagine the consequences of a loss of sea ice for ocean transportation, and what that then might mean for industrial development in the Arctic, it seems fairly clear that the answer to that question might depend on what's happening on the land surface. If the land surface stability falls apart, then improved shipping may have very little effect on development on the Arctic coast. On the other hand, if land surface stability is fine, then there might be a huge impact. So it seemed that in many cases, it was the simultaneous nature of these changes that was really important for understanding impacts. And then the third thing that we thought about was that there are feedbacks, both direct and indirect, between the land and the ocean surface. So, for example, as the land surface changes, one of the consequences that's been measured has been a dramatic increase in freshwater runoff into the Arctic Ocean, and that has implications for the ocean itself. On the other hand, you can imagine a reduction of sea ice is going to enhance warming that may then feed back on land surface change. So these really are functionally a fairly coupled system, directly or indirectly. We therefore thought it might be worthy to look at them together. So next slide. But as I said, we can discuss that because I know there are a range of opinions on that subject. So when we were thinking about how one might go about defining science priorities for Arctic surface change, Lil actually had the idea of dividing the Arctic system, including both the land and the ocean, into three categories of processes, and I've changed her original wording a little bit. But basically, the three categories are that there's a whole set of things that are land surface processes that have to do with vegetation and permafrost and all of that land-based stuff. And then there's a set of processes that really have to do with the ocean surface, that have to do with the formation and destruction of sea ice and all of that sort of purely ocean science. And then the part that I think, at least to me, got really interesting was that red box in the middle, those linking processes that are the ways that either directly or indirectly the land and the ocean surface interact. So we're using that as our conceptual framework at the moment of thinking of those three categories. So if we can go to the next slide. I want to go through the next part. There's a lot of text, all of which is pulled directly from the document on science priorities that I'm hoping folks have had a chance to at least gaze at quickly. So I'm going to go through these fairly quickly in order to get to the part where you start talking. But what we did was took each of those boxes, land processes, ocean processes, and linking processes, and tried to define key research questions. And you'll notice as we go along that the ocean questions are a lot more poorly developed because we were unsuccessful in our attempts to woo an ocean person to help us out. So there's still some work needed on those in particular, but these will at least give you an idea of the kinds of things that we were beginning to identify as being important. So as far as land surface processes, we came up with four key research questions, and in some ways these are more examples of research questions than necessarily the defining questions, but they'll give you a sense of what we were thinking. That there's a question about the rate at which vegetation change is happening, and we were focusing on the rate of woody vegetation expansion. I think when we get to discussion, we can talk about the other components of vegetation change that might want to be added to that, so we're not so shrub-centric here. So the rates of expansion and what factors are controlling expansion and what the hot spots are where the rates of change are greatest, so really starting to try to tackle the spatial heterogeneity within the Arctic in terms of change. The second question is mirroring the previous overarching questions and asks about drivers. So what are the relative importance of climate forcing versus cumulative development impacts as drivers of changes in the Arctic land surface, and how are those expected to change in the future? The third question we came to has to do with feedbacks and what the feedbacks on the Arctic climate system are with land surface change and what the trajectory of those feedbacks is likely to be over the next century or so. And then the fourth question has to do with how land surface change affects human activity, including both subsistence use and industrial scale development. So looking at, you know, how increased shrubs affect subsistence use of caribou, for example, as well as how loss of permafrost, for example, might affect industrial scale development. So really thinking broadly about human activity. Next slide. So what we then did was think about, if one were to tackle those questions, what are the key variables? So what we were thinking might be handy to be able to give to the ARCS committee would be a table that said, here are the variables that we think ought to be studied, and here's why we really think they're central. And so for the land surface, this is our list, and I suspect there are things that could be taken off or added to this, and hopefully we'll get some ideas about that. But that answering those questions that I showed you on the previous slide would require that we understand that list of variables: permafrost dynamics, vegetation change, nutrient cycles, food web dynamics, industrial development, transportation, and the harvest of land animal populations. I think you'll see as we go through these next few slides that I worry that we're in grave danger of becoming the community of practice of everything, and that it would be really good to make sure that these lists really include the essential things to studying surface change and aren't simply laundry lists. So this was our sense of what the key land surface variables would be to look at. And then if we go to the next slide, I can show you our thinking on ocean surface processes. We came up with three questions with respect, key questions with respect to ocean surface processes. The first is, again, a trajectory question to mirror the structure of the land questions in terms of what the most likely trajectory of future sea ice in both summer and winter is, as well as what the spatial dynamics are. And as far as the spatial dynamics go, for those of you, any of you who are interested in looking at such things, there's a really cool animation on NASA's website that I was going to put in this presentation, but it just sounded like it was complicated. So, but if you want to take a look at it, there's a really neat animation of the time series of sea ice since I think 1979 that makes it clear that there's really interesting spatial heterogeneity that might warrant somebody looking at it. The second question we came up with was about feedbacks on the Arctic climate system associated with changes in sea ice dynamics. So again, it's very parallel to the questions we came up with on land. And then the third question is about the implications of sea surface change for subsistence resource use, for commercial fisheries, for transportation. So again, human activity broadly defined. And then if we go to the next slide, we did a similar exercise and asked ourselves what variables one might want to look at if one were to answer those questions. And again, this is the thinking of a bunch of largely terrestrial ecologists and human dimensions people about oceans. So I know that there are things missing, and I'm hoping that some of you more marine savvy people can add some words to this slide. But the things that jumped out to us were sea ice cover and thickness, food web dynamics, transportation, and patterns of harvest of ocean animal populations. And then if we go to the next slide, the final set of variables we thought about were these linking variables that in some ways are sort of, I guess to me, the more interesting questions that ask about how these things interact. The first question asks about direct feedbacks between, or direct relationships between land surface change and ocean surface change. So what are the ways in which the land and the ocean surface directly interact with each other? So we're thinking about things like runoff, how runoff from land affects ocean dynamics, coastal erosion, that kind of really direct interaction, and how the trajectory of those direct feedbacks is going to change. Those are sort of the factors that really directly unite the land and the ocean domain. And then the second question was about these potentially non-additive interactions between ocean and land surface change, particularly with respect to industrial development. So what are the ways in which the implications of land surface change are dependent on the ocean and vice versa? What are those more indirect couplings between land and ocean surface change? And we ask that both about industrial development and about subsistence resource use. So what are the implications of having a simultaneous disruption of land and ocean-based food webs? Is it simply an additive effect, or is there some new problem that arises when you have both of those happening at once? So next slide. So the variables we came up with in terms of the linking variables, for those of you who can see the screen, show up in red, and I know some of them don't show up very well, but we have things like runoff and coastal erosion, And then transportation and industrial development are a mechanism by which land and ocean change are linked. The harvest of animal populations is a way in which they're linked in the sense that, for example, if changes in ocean food resources, if there are changes in ocean food resources, that will certainly, in some places, have implications for the use of land-based food resources. So those two things are linked. And then there are processes like CO2 exchange and surface heat exchange that are going to link the trajectories of the land and the ocean surface via the Arctic atmosphere. So that's where we've gotten so far. And I think that we've got a reasonable set of variables here, but as I said, I worry a little bit that we've kind of included everything but the kitchen sink. So what we really want to do in the rest of the time that we have is think hard about what the really essential things that we need to know are about surface change. And indeed, we can also, if there's interest, have discussion about this whole notion of collective surface change and whether we really ought to be thinking simultaneously about the land and the ocean. So if we go to the next slide, we will pause on this one for a bit. There were two questions that emerged for us that I particularly want feedback on, but I'm absolutely willing to let this go more broadly. The first has to do with really defining this essential set of variables. I'd love feedback on what the essential things are that we've left out. So are there variables that jump out at you that should be on the list that is showing up on the right if you're on WIMBA? And on the other hand, are there variables that you see on that list that you really think are non-essential? I think in the interest of being useful to the ARCS committee, we really need to pare this down to the most essential things. So if there's somebody out there who thinks that transportation is really fairly unimportant, it would be great to hear that as well so that we can really take off the things that aren't central to our overall goal of understanding surface change. So I'm going to stop talking there. I will happily field questions, comments on this. I need to sign off at about 1:45, so we've got 45 minutes, so I'd like to suggest, you know, we spend about half that time on each of the two major discussion questions. The other had to do with the human dimensions piece, and kind of see where we go. So, does anybody care to raise their hand and offer a thought or a comment or a question? Yay, Skip. Skip, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do. The diagram that you've come up with here, I like it, but I also think it might be worth taking a look. NOAA has been working along the same lines with their State of the Arctic assessment, linking the ocean with the land surface issues, and it might be worth looking at the diagram they came up with. It's quite a different diagram, but there's a lot of parallels, and I think we should acknowledge that they're coming at it from the ocean side. We're coming at it from the land side. Our focus is more on the processes going on the land, and theirs are more what's going on the ocean. But we're both recognizing the need for linking these two domains in the Arctic. And it seems like it would be good to maybe include their diagram and really acknowledge the work that they've been doing in trying to come up with this state-of-the-Arctic assessment.
Yeah, that would. Can you send me? Is there a diagram available online or something?
Don Perovich is also involved with that group, and Jackie. What's Jackie's name, Don?
Vermeggie.
Yes. She's leading that. She's got the diagram right now. I don't have a copy of the diagram, but we can get you her name and her address and everything.
That would be great.
Okay.
I can get her to send that to you. She's just down the hall from me.
Great. Thanks, Don. Steve Solomon's hand is up, perhaps.
Yeah, as someone who kind of works with one foot in the water and one foot on land, I have a couple of things to say about the marine environment, but I also appreciate your concern about including everything. A couple of things about the nature of, say, for instance, the sea ice reduction that we often see in the show it. What we see on a local scale or kind of within the land fast zone, we don't necessarily see the same kinds of trends occurring in terms of the dramatic changes in the extent and distribution. So I'd argue that we do need to go beyond the simple satellite-based observations using very coarse resolution imagery to look at things on a more detailed level close to the coastline. And another thing I did want to mention was the fact that changes in sea ice distribution will lead to changes in things like waves and currents in the near shore, which are going to have significant impact not only on things like coast erosion, but human use of the coast. In particular, people who use small boats will be subjected to much greater kind of wave forces, and as sea ice continues to increase, and people in the Beaufort certainly are already indicating.
Can you speak up a little bit? We're really having a hard time hearing him.
Sorry?
Can Steve speak up a bit?
Is this any better?
Oh, much better.
Okay, sorry. My speakerphone is not very full of speakerphone. I was just suggesting that in addition to paying close attention to the distribution of sea ice in the coastal zone rather than kind of the polar view from the satellite course scale where the coastal zone is, in fact, I would say considered to be noise in the distribution or a noise in their sensors, that we also need to pay attention perhaps to the changes in wave climate and current climate which are going to result from changes in the sea ice distribution, not only for coastal erosion impacts but also for impacts related to people's use of the coastal zone, in that small boats become very very much more dangerous as sea ice retreats and larger waves and stronger winds associated with perhaps increased storminess may affect people's ability to access those resources.
That's great. That's really helpful. And it sounds like your comment about needing to look at fine scale heterogeneity, it mirrors a lot of the conversations that the terrestrial folks have had amongst ourselves about the need to do similar things on land to really get a handle on that. Other comments, thoughts, suggestions?
This is Dan White. I don't have my hand up. Is it all right for
Yes, we'll let you talk, Dan.
Okay. I guess I was looking at your second point there, what variables or processes that are included or non-essential and can be left behind, and I guess that while I agree that I don't think we want to detail an extensive laundry list on this, I guess I don't see any kinds of variables that are not integrated into the entire surface dynamic that we can say, okay, well, that particular variable we're leaving behind because it operates independently and doesn't affect the rest of the ecosystem or the human dynamic. So in that sense, I think there may be things that have minimal impact on short time scales or long time scales. Certainly that makes a difference in the process. But, maybe it's rather than look for things to include or look for things to not include, I think in the beginning of the paper we kind of look at, or that you guys put together, kind of look at the important kinds of processes and then, the individuals that are looking at these processes kind of can include the variables that make the difference at the time scale that they're considering.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And at one point, Heidi and I were emailing back and forth, Heidi Stelter and I, about trying to add a temporal dimension to the matrix so that we could sort of identify the variables whose importance was largely expressed on very long time scales. And that made my head hurt, and I never got very far with it. But that might be something we want to explore, maybe with just a couple of variables to kind of get that sense that at different time scales, there may be variables that are more and less important.
And spatial scales, too.
And right, exactly.
So Josh Schimmel has his hand up.
Yeah. I guess my concern about the diagram, which I think is an excellent sort of conceptual framework, is that it's largely a conceptual way of expressing Arctic system science.
Yeah.
I mean, it sort of ties together everything we think we know, except usually those diagrams have a map as the base instead of sort of a conceptual focus.
Mm-hmm.
And so within that large context, yes, all of these things are really important, and they are, you know, the important variables to understand. But as sort of the framework for a more, you know, what's supposed to be a community of practice, a more focused group, this doesn't leave anybody out. It really is everything. But
yeah.
I don't have any particularly good insight of how once you've framed surface dynamics as the target, how you don't really include all of these things, because surface dynamics is the integrating variable in many ways.
Right. Yeah, does it, I mean, are there hands up with thoughts about that?
This is Gus. But I'm thinking about what Josh said at the end there, what I was thinking when he was saying this covers everything. I was thinking, no, this really doesn't cover everything, because the central issue is one of surface characteristics. What this doesn't include, for example, is biodiversity issues.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't include a lot of things. And in many ways, that's good, because what it means is that it's a focused program on issues of surface interactions and surface energy balance. That's fine. So it's sort of one slice through a multidimensional space. And, you know, I think that's fine. I think the real question is not whether the diagram that's on the screen now encompasses everything, but whether the surface energy balance focus is too narrow.
Can I interrupt for a sec?
Well, let me just finish. I think that it is, in many ways, a surface energy balance focus or a surface focus is an appropriate way to focus that. But what we may be doing is leaving out other well-integrated programs that would represent different slices through this same hyperspace. Go ahead, Josh.
Yeah, that you have you've defined this as a surface energy focus, and that's not at all what I see here. And issues like biodiversity are integral to understanding vegetation change, for example. And as I see, this has been defined as it's a surface cover focus, and what are the influences of surface cover, and what are the mechanisms that drive changes in surface cover, and that's why I really see it as being very much sort of a way of integrating a focus on the whole Arctic system. It's not just the energy, that's simply one aspect of what's been put down on this. I don't think we ever really anticipated this as being just a surface energy exchange community of practice. It's about surface cover.
I think I agree with you, Josh. I should have said cover. But even if you say cover, you're still talking about a slice through a big complex space and not necessarily the whole space. And I think that's appropriate.
Sarah, this is John Wegley. I was going to hopefully get a chance to just interject on that a little bit, if I got a chance here.
Yeah.
I also have to sign off in just a few minutes, so I want to get a chance to say something. I think a good example of the distinction there between sort of this community and the surface cover and what's sort of included and what's not is you think about the land-based, you know, cryosphere and ice mass. You know, certainly it's a key indicator for changes that are going on. And it was certainly, you know, shown as an example of, you know, decreasing ice mass, particularly over in North America. But in terms of, I mean, I think typically in this community that sort of is developing for community practice, you know, the ice mass and, you know, ice mass balance over the land is not necessarily a big, you know, active part of these kind of, you know, transfers of what's going on. It's certainly big on the heat at surface heat exchange. An indicator, but I think in terms of what most of the people are studying, it's not necessarily, other than a source of water and everything else, not a big part of the study of this. And I think it's fine to cut that as a slice where we're talking about other processes, mostly, you know, a lot of summer active processes in animals and things like that that are not necessarily on ice sheets. And I think that's a fine way to cut it in terms of this. I don't think even though the sea ice and cryosphere of the ocean part is a key component of the summer, how things are distributed. It's probably not as important to have it on the land as other than the seasonal snow cover and how that's both variable and interacting with the vegetation, which is a key part of this and part of the transportation and everything else. But the ice cover things, I think it's still okay to just sort of, it's not everything on the surface that affects the cover that has to be included. So I think this is still supposed to be a really good cut at some of the important processes that people look at. So.
Good. Yeah, and I think part of our logic for what we included and didn't include, we were at the end at least really thinking about this through the lens of what's going to affect humans and their use of the Arctic land and ocean surface. So I think that's part of the decision-making process. More hands up.
Yes.
Wendy, are you calling on people or should I?
So we've got Gary Kofinas next and then Steve Solomon after. Gary, you had a comment or question?
Gary?
Oh, Gary?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Now we can.
Okay, now you can. All right. Learning to use this phone. Just a minor comment about the final point you have on harvest of land, animal populations. If we limit this thing to surface changes in the surface, and we don't include either biodiversity category or an animal, a wildlife or upper trophic level category, then I think we might be missing something. If you think about reindeer herding on the, the Yamal, you have herding that has a feedback in terms of herbivory affecting vegetation. You may not have any harvest of animals, but animals being part of the surface having an effect on the system. So I'm just making a it seems as if we go from veg and we jump right to the kinds of things people are doing there without anything in between.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if we might change. Maybe it's food. It's captured in food web dynamics, or maybe it's some other way that we can have that as a place marker in there.
No, I agree. That would be great to make that more explicit. And as I recall in our conversations, we started using the phrase food web dynamics because we couldn't think of a good word for upper trophic level dynamics, but upper trophic level actually works quite nicely. So I think making that more explicit is important, and I think we could get rid of the word harvest because what I was really thinking was things like reindeer herding and such that really, strictly speaking, aren't harvest. So that would be great. Those are really helpful.
Is it Steve Solomon's next, I think?
Hello. I was just occurring to me that one of the places that oceans and land interact most intimately and most significantly, perhaps, is in deltas, and I'm thinking perhaps of the large deltas surrounding the Arctic as being areas that we might think about focusing on. Just as a quick example, some of the work that Tor Jorgensen has done in the Colville Delta and we're currently doing in the Mackenzie Delta area are looking at the interactions between changing sea level, changing land surface elevations as a result of subsidence, in part because of permafrost thaw, coastal flooding due to storm surges, which may be exacerbated due to loss of sea ice. There's a real, very intimate and quite a dramatic interaction between the land and the ocean in places where the land is fairly low. And we certainly see the impacts on vegetation. I wouldn't be surprised if there are also impacts on animal populations or fish populations as well. So we might think about in this community of practice as having perhaps one focus area which looks at impacts on large deltas in particular.
Mm-hmm. Great. Any other hands up? Nope. So what I seem to be hearing is that it doesn't sound like there's overwhelming concern about this becoming the co-op of everything, that folks are fairly comfortable that this is a focus on surface processes and that there are things we're leaving out appropriately. So, and now we have two more hands up.
Yep,
Matt Berman?
That comment that you just made was simultaneous with me thinking about the community of everything. Just about all the human activity in the Arctic takes place on the surface. And so it's virtually impossible to keep this community of practice from really appropriating just about all of the HARC program, just because that's, you know, that's where people, even when you're flying in an airplane, you have to take off and land on the surface, and you know, lakes freezing or thawing or whatever is going to affect that. So it's just something for us to keep in mind.
Yes.
I think it's unavoidable that we will capture all of this, pretty much all of the human dimension of the Arctic system.
And the second discussion question I have is how to be a little bit more perhaps complex and intelligent in our treatment of the human dimensions piece. So we can pick up on that in a few minutes when we've exhausted this topic. Wendy.
Yes. This is Wendy Eisner. I just am coming in a little late, but and coming in sort of from the Salt Lake Dynamics COPS group, just wanting to point out that of course there's going to be a lot of linkages between these different groups, and I can see a lot. As soon as you start talking about processes, there's a lot of overlap, which I think is a good thing with the Salt Lake group.
Mm-hmm.
And almost by definition, when you talk about also the relationship between land, ocean, deltaic surfaces, you're also going into the hydrology, and of course that's also, you know, overlaps strongly with you can't study one without the other. So
right.
I see a lot of positive overlap, and I think, you know, I think I'm the only one from the Salt Lake COPS group calling in, but as I understood, when we talked, we also saw a lot of positive kinds of links between this COPS group and the Salt Lake one.
That's great. And I one of the things that I was hoping, that I hope to do next round of revisions on this priorities document, is include a section at the end that really makes those explicit, because I agree that having these areas of overlap is probably a useful signal to people reading these prospectuses that there are multiple groups that are converging on similar ideas, and to the extent that we can really articulate those, I think it would be helpful. And probably ditto for Matt's comment about ingesting the HARC program with this, that to the extent that we can really make those linkages clear to the other communities of practice, I think that would be helpful. So I'm hoping to add a little piece at the end that really makes those clear.
Mm-hmm.
So that's great. Doni?
Doni Bretthart. I would just wanted to say that one of the things that I like about this framework actually is that it's in some ways, you're worried about it being too general, but I like the fact that it's general and it's not sort of focused on anybody's particular research agenda, that many people can fall within it. And I think that keeping that as a general framework is a really good thing. So I would actually, I think that it is, as Jeff described it, it is one slice through a very large, complex, multidimensional space, but it is still general enough that that a lot of individual research topics of concern can fit within it, and I think that's very appropriate for this sort of an endeavor.
Great. Josh.
Yeah. I come back to the concern I raised a little bit of, you know, and said, well, this encompasses all of HARC or this encompasses all of something else, that what we need to be very clear is how we present this, is that this isn't subsuming those, that this has a cross-cut focus, and it has a focus on surface cover as a focus that doesn't simply capture everything everybody else is doing.
Right.
Because it could easily be seen as that, and it could easily inflate to everything that has anything to do with this as part of this, in which case, yes, all of HARC suddenly becomes part of us, all of Salt Lake suddenly becomes part of us, that this is a conceptual focus that is integrative and synthetic. And what appropriately falls in, you know, this focus is not everything that has anything to do that happens on the surface. It's not incidental of, yes, it's happening on the surface, therefore it's us. It's what are the things that are regulating the surface cover of the Arctic.
That's good. I like that. I think it would be we could very easily add some text that makes it clear what both what we are and what we are not. Dan.
Well, I mean, one way maybe to phrase that is back to the issue of scale, and rather than saying you know, something is too broad or not broad enough, is just say we in this surface dynamic group are kind of looking at a large scale, and it may be that you know, there's also an Arctic hydrology COP, and that COP is looking maybe at a different scale, spatial scale or time scale. So we can, I mean, the two or I mean, multiple kinds of COPs can coexist because we're, I mean, they are important to us and we may be important to them, but we're kind of looking at different, at least, you know, kind of when I think of this diagram, looking at very different scales.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way of thinking about it. Mary Beth.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the HARC stuff. First of all, I don't think that this encompasses everything that might be under the umbrella of human dimensions research by any stretch of the imagination, and that's totally fine. I don't think it should. I think that some of these other co-ops will have human dimensions elements built in as appropriate, and I think I would agree with Dan that it is a question of scale, and on the human dimensions side, there are some questions that are going to be appropriate at the scale of the surface dynamics co-op and others that are not. So I'm not sure what the concerns are there, but I don't think that you should be worried about how the human dimensions fits in. It will fit in as appropriate, you know. I think that's all I want to say right now.
Okay, thank you. Neil.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I'm trying to lie back and just listen on this, but we are all exploring new ideas here, and particularly the way we're doing things, and so no one really knows even what the ultimate purpose of a given COP might be. But I believe that what the ARCS committee may be looking for when you come up with your ideas ultimately is not just, is this a new way of cutting across a rather complicated system, but does looking at it in this way give us the opportunity to learn something that we can't learn by looking at it another way?
Hmm.
And I think that's something that you've all been sort of skirting around, but I haven't heard anyone actually say that. What new are you going to learn by looking at it this way? And I think that's probably more important than worrying about whether you're encompassing everything in one or another group within the program. Something you might think about anyway.
I think that's a good question. I'm going to let Josh speak, but I want to come back to that. And what I'll say sort of briefly in answer to that is that I think as we pulled this document together, what we began to think about was that looking collectively at land and ocean surface change and thinking about these linking processes was a really different way of looking at things than simply doing what we've always done and have the land folks work with the land folks and the ocean folks with the ocean folks. And I think I would like some feedback from the community on whether that's achievable, whether it's worthy, because I know at least one-on-one I've had conversations with several people that suggest that there's some divergence of opinion about that. But let's go to Doni and then Josh, it looks like. Is
that
right?
Me, I think. Go ahead to Josh.
Okay, yeah, I'd like to come back to the issue of scale, and I think it's important to define the target scale, but at least the way I see research is that research that's focused even at a large scale doesn't necessarily happen at that scale.
Mm-hmm.
That the interscale linkages that actually drive changes in process can be critical, and so that even if you're talking about, you know, large-scale changes in, say, you know, shrubbiness on the Arctic, but the actual work you do may need to scale that down to really understand mechanisms and details, but that as you frame that, a specific project is still going to be very much targeted at understanding the large-scale changes, whatever actual experiments it does. So I think that wasn't super clear, but the target scale is important, not the scale at which you do the work.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, what we did in coming up with these processes was think about the things that are important at a large scale, but I agree with Josh
right.
completely that that doesn't mean that we're all doing circumarctic remote sensing as
yeah.
a tool.
That I think is critical, that understanding not only the interdisciplinary linkages that drive these things, but the interscale linkages that drive these things
right.
is a key element of a good research program.
I like that. All right, since nobody has a hand up, let me ask you all a question on this topic. Are people comfortable with the notion of thinking about the linkages between the various components of surface change, in particular land and ocean surface change? Does that feel like a gimmick to you that we've done in order to look inclusive, or does it feel like a meaningful and new way of doing business? Or none of the above?
Elements of both.
Steve Solomon's got his hand up, Andy.
Okay, Steve?
I guess for me it's kind of a no-brainer, because working as a coastal geologist, it's kind of inherent in the territory.
Right.
It's perhaps a little harder for me to think. I guess it's more of a big picture question when you're looking, it seems to me, at the larger scale linkages between runoff and into the ocean and how the ocean may feed back. One of my challenges, kind of to get down to the kind of more to the details, is some of the issues that I'm dealing with are not necessarily, I haven't found, attractive to most oceanographers. Oceanographers tend to think kind of bigger picture perhaps than the more local scale heterogeneous kinds of phenomena that I'm looking at. So one of the challenges, and this goes back to where you were asking feedback and Neil's question, is to what extent would we be looking simply for, say, tame oceanographers to help with understanding terrestrial phenomena,
mm-hmm.
And to what extent would we be looking at partnerships or collaborations which are truly interactive, and those might be a bit more challenging to come up with.
Yeah, I agree. Dan.
Well, I think this is, at least especially from the discussion we had in Seattle that this came out of, is that this is really a well-integrated kind of natural science, social science group. And while those efforts, of course, in the Freshwater Initiative were working very hard to integrate closely the human dimension and the natural sciences, and I think this COP especially kind of brings all that together, and I think that's one of the really important things about what the document and what the group is doing.
Yeah, and that's I'm going to take a couple more comments on this issue, and then I want to turn to the human dimensions bit, because I think that was one of the really exciting things that happened in Seattle, was that we really began to think about integrating the natural and the social sciences, as opposed to just sort of shaking hands with each other once in a while. So I want to make sure to leave time to get to those issues. So Skip, you want to have the last word on the subject?
Okay.
Whatever the subject happens to be.
I'm coming back to is there something we want to eliminate here? And you initially brought up the idea or the question about transportation, and I'm wondering if that's really such a big thing for this group. Certainly it's important if we're thinking about, what the impacts of opening up the marine highways, and roads on the land and everything, but it seems like it's included in industrial development to some extent.
Mm.
Unless there's some big issue here that I'm not seeing, do we really want to have a separate category for transportation?
Yeah, we could link it up with industrial development.
Yeah. May I comment on that, please?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, Martin Miles here. I don't have a hand to put up.
Oh, you're right.
I was going to make a comment also looking at the science document, which I like very much, but under the ocean surface variables, for example, there's transportation, but not a separate one for industrial development. But I think, I agree with Skip that both for land and for ocean, we could do transportation and industrial development. And on the ocean part, I'm thinking about oil and gas development offshore, which at least in the you know, Barents Sea kerosene is happening. I was at this AMAP oil and gas in the Arctic conference in St. Petersburg about 3 months ago, and it's sort of it's basically revving up, and I think within 10 years it's going to transform both coastal infrastructure and the marine environment in Barents and at least western kerosene within the next decade. So I think it's going to be very, very important. I think it's fine to put them both as, you know, just transportation and industrial development without making them separate.
That's great.
I think they're linked a lot.
Thank you. All right, Matt Berman, you want to have the real last word?
Oh, that's fine. I sent a very similar comment to the chat, but I don't know that it ever got posted, so I agree with that. But I was just wanted to point out that subsistence users also have to get across the land and water, so that's why I think they were transportation and industrial development separate.
So what we could do just to be consistent is make it clear in the text that when we're thinking about subsistence use and industrial development, we're considering transportation as being a key aspect of that, but perhaps not pull it out as a variable.
And that it affects both subsistence and industrial development.
I'd like to go on to the next discussion question simply because I'm going to have to hang up in 15 minutes. But what I'd like to ask is that if you folks over the next several days or week can contemplate this question about whether there's something we're leaving out, can contemplate the question of what it is that to you as you read this seems really novel, exciting. If you can sort of think about these questions more, if people come up with more thoughts in the aftermath of this meeting, please feel free to email them to me, and I'll be busily incorporating all of this into the document over the next few weeks. So I hope the dialogue can continue after we finish talking about this today. So, Mary Beth, did you have one final thought?
Oh, my comment was going to be on the transportation, and really it's a question of scale, and with respect to all of the human dimensions components here, you might want to think about the different scales. So if you're talking about industrial development, then you might have, that's one scale, and animal harvest can be looked at a variety of different scales as well. So I think that the same way that you think about scale with respect to these other issues of, say, vegetation or food webs, you need to think about the human dimensions in these different scales. And that may help to kind of refine some of the language that you use and with issues related to things like transportation and stuff like that.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so carrying on with human dimensions, now that we've happily turned that way anyway, I wanted to think some about how we can refine our treatment of the human dimension. Right now, humans are showing up in this diagram largely as in terms of development, in terms of, you know, using resources and so on. And I think it was Gary that at some point during, as we were emailing this document back and forth over the last few weeks, I think Gary Kosinas made a comment that there was nothing in here about policy, which, especially if we're thinking about large scales of space and time, space in particular, it's sort of national and international policy institutions that are integral players in this. And I just, not being a human dimensions person, am a little lost in how to incorporate that kind of thing, how to refine the treatment of the human dimensions, how to continue what I think was one of the really exciting things about Seattle, the Seattle meeting that started this all, which was that really there was an integrated group of social scientists and natural scientists. So I know that's not a very focused discussion question, but any thoughts you have on the treatment of the human dimensions, ways we can refine it, variables that we're missing, or, you know, ways we can treat things differently, I would welcome at this point. Josh.
Yeah, I would keep this sort of conceptual framework simplistic. There's a lot of mechanism that goes into each of these elements, both the scientific and the social science. And rather than trying to, you know, pull out and make them all, you know, explicit, I would try to actually collapse these things a little bit.
Yeah.
And then allow the mechanisms that drive things to flow out of the more specifics of, well, how do you do this? You know, what are the things that are changing human use of the surface? I mean, some some of that is ecological and some of that is policy and economics driven. So, you know, I think we can embed some of those things as mechanisms that are drivers rather than, you know, actively kind of pull them out and make them explicit in sort of the conceptual framework of what the COP is about. The more the COP is focused on this is the target issue and this is the target scale, I think it keeps a clearer focus of what we are and what we are not.
So are you suggesting that rather than try to really specify the different types of human use, we really think about human use broadly and then what's driving and then concentrate on the drivers in our conceptual framework? Is that?
Yeah, I think we, you know, within a relatively short document, you could have a section saying, you know, human use is both very sensitive to changes of Earth surface cover, and it is a driver of changes in Earth surface cover, and then you could elaborate some of those to sort of illustrate that we recognize that policy, that large-scale global economics are going to be drivers and are going to be responders as well,
mm-hmm.
but not try to put too much of those kinds of issues up front, not try to make it sound like, you know, all of the different ways in which human activity is relevant to this question, because as we've heard, some of it is not so immediately direct. You know, we don't want to sound like we are incorporating all of human activity in the Arctic.
Okay.
This COP, I think, is not doing that, but there are elements of human mechanisms that are essential to capture within this focus.
Okay. Over on the left, Bill, Neil and Bill have been emailing. Neil, does your question need a response? Isn't that all that under the category of surface use?
No response needed.
Okay, no response needed. Bill Manley, do you want a response?
Yeah.
Okay, so Bill, for those of you who are not looking at the computer screen, says, could you clarify industrial development, a semantic issue perhaps, but perhaps the concern for direct human impacts on surface environments might be more clearly identified as infrastructure development? Yes. Where we came up with, I actually think infrastructure development would be good, and it also parallels some of the, I think that's how Globio is talking about development in terms of infrastructure, so that might be a nice parallel wording. What we were really thinking separately about subsistence human use of the Arctic and development that has to do with road building and gravel pads and oil refineries and or oil drilling wells and that sort of thing. So infrastructure development sounds really good to me.
Yeah, I was just thinking that there is a great deal of human impact on the environment beyond what's being done specifically by industry.
Yeah. Yes.
And it sounds like you're on top of all that.
Yeah, no, that sounds really good.
And Dan White had his hand raised.
Well,
hi, Dan.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on that. And I think, you know, Matt Berman pointed this out earlier, is that, yeah, the industrial development and certainly things like dams and reservoirs have a significant impact on the surface. We're also needing, I mean, one key element of the human dimension is whether or not subsistence users have, or how the snow and the ice impact the subsistence users' ability to get to their resource. And so it's not just is infrastructure development impacting the surface on the Arctic, but how is changes in the surface in the Arctic impacting humans and their abilities to continue in lifestyles or get to resources, whether it's subsistence users or oil companies or miners. So I guess I'm reluctant to kind of wrap everything into industrial development or infrastructure for that matter.
Right, and I was not implying that everything gets wrapped up into that, but I agree with you completely that there are really compelling questions about how changes in the Arctic surface affect lifestyles, access to resources, that kind of thing. And I would not want to collapse that down into infrastructure. I think what I was suggesting was that what we're calling industrial development, what we're really talking about is building infrastructure and the impact zones associated with those infrastructures. And then I think the issues of access to resources, ease of travel over the Arctic surface, those all remain a separate piece, I think. Does that make sense? Okay. Mary Beth.
I think you actually just said what I was going to say, Andy, which is that you need to, you might want to think about the human dimensions, whether it's industrial development, infrastructure, whatever, in terms of impacts of human activity and impacts on human activity, which is really simple-minded, but in fact sort of encompasses it all, and then how those feedbacks work, and it's give some fairly plain language for discussing it.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Because one of my comments was going to be is frequently this stuff with respect to the human dimensions is always looked at from the perspective of impacts on people.
Right.
And I think it's important to include both of them.
Yeah, and I think we all felt really strongly about that when this
idea
first came up, that having humans there as drivers was really important. Matt.
Yeah, I think I agree with Mary Beth. I think my chat is disabled because but I suggested that we say infrastructure and disturbance.
Yep, it's there.
Okay, so I think that would take care of it. I'm struck by the comment that I think Skip made to me about how if you look at the Arctic, you can see the track of seismic activity that's been done in the winter and that's the surface impact that has nothing to do with infrastructure, but it's related to industrial.
Matt, we can barely hear you.
Matt, you want to repeat last part of what you just said?
Skip pointed out to me that you can see the effects of seismic activity in the North Slope, which is a disturbance on the surface that is associated with industrial activity, but it's not infrastructure per se. So that's why I suggested the disturbance. In regard to what Dan said, if we look long enough into the future, we might see expansion of forestry and agriculture in the subarctic that would have potentially landscape-level effects. So the surface effects of human activity could be things that we don't yet identify. But
right.
I favor keeping it broad.
Good. No, I like that's a nice clarification. Skip.
Yes, I just wanted to. I thought Mary Beth's idea was really excellent. It covers all of this the effects of and on human activity.
Mm-hmm.
That seems really simple and covers industrial development and the effects of changes in sea ice and everything else without getting too specific as to whether it's industrial or infrastructure or harvest of animals or what.
Yeah.
It includes everything.
Yeah. I like that idea. Yeah. Simplifying is good. All right. Any last comments on this? Okay. Do we have a concluding slide? Was there some placeholder slide that said I was supposed to think deep thoughts at this point? Ah, there we go. Excellent. I don't need to add anything to that. Those of you who can't see the computer, there's a slide that says summary and nothing else. So I think this is where I try to summarize. I have 5 pages of detailed notes of everything I hope that everybody said. And I think, so my sense of the consensus of the group at this point is that that we need to be very attentive to not becoming the co-op of everything, but that I'm sensing a fair degree of comfort with where we are right now, and that the tasks ahead of us are to make it really clear to ourselves and to readers of the document what's novel about this approach and what we can learn from this approach that other approaches would not give us, to try to simplify the conceptual framework with respect to humans and other aspects a bit. Those are really the big things, to make the linkages to the other communities of practice. What I'd like to suggest happen from here is that I am going to take a swing at revising the science priorities document based on these comments and some comments I've gotten by email over the last couple of days. And I will make that available to people who've participated today. I'll also put it up on the website associated with this community of practice. So anybody who's participating today who hasn't officially signed up to be part of the co-op and would like to, you can send an email to, would Laura be the person?
Yep. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, if you want to send an email to Laura and let her know, what I'll do is post a copy of this document up on the website. I'll email it around. And I think it would be great if this conversation could continue over the next few weeks, and I'll try incorporating these comments, but I suspect I'm going to have lots of questions for you all. So as you think of things over the next several days, please email me, and we'll see if we can sort of move from here to make this a really workable document. I think the ideas are exciting, and I very much appreciate all the feedback that you guys have given today. So,
Andy.
Yeah.
This is Jeff Welker.
Hi, Jeff.
One comment that we're getting close to the end, and one of the subjects that Skip has brought up here over the email the last few days is kind of the approach that we would take in dealing with these issues. So the diagram kind of is a hypothetical place where the terrestrial and oceans link, but
well,
one thing we haven't talked about
place.
Is, you know, what is the approach that we would use to deal with this? And so right now we've all been having discussions about kind of spatial aspects, multiple sites, transects, and it seems that some of this discussion should be incorporated into the document in terms of how we would deal with these kind of terrestrial ocean linkages, changes in the land surface.
Yeah. I'll clarify that the document is actually not supposed to represent some point in space so much as a conceptual map. I think the issue of approaches is a tricky one because in a very short document that's really defining priorities, we can't get into approaches, and I don't think this is the time to really get into how we're going to do this. On the other hand, I know that Skip and others have made a very compelling case for the fact that whatever we do, it has to be integrated. It has to be circumarctic. And so I think one way we might deal with that is to really strengthen the discussion of the scale that we're thinking about, because I think if we make it clear that we're really thinking at a large spatial scale, that immediately defines some approaches or rules out some approaches. And then maybe think about some text that says something to the effect that something about the implications of working at that scale. So if you have thoughts, or if anybody has thoughts about sort of brief, succinct text we might add that isn't so much a proposal of here's what we think we ought to do, but kind of something about the implications of these priorities for the science that's going to have to be done, that would be really helpful. And I know Skip has sent me a lot already, so I've got some from Skip. But, Jeff, if you have additional thoughts, I would welcome those.
Okay.
I'm going to try to work that in. Skip, you have your hand up.
Yes. I'm a little concerned here that, you know, our greening of, and I hate to come back to the greening of the Arctic issues, but there's an awful lot of retracing of the thinking that went into the greening of the Arctic proposal here, and I'm wondering how we can really distinguish this from the greening of the Arctic work, because that's already in progress, and it seems like, in some sense, we've already been there with this discussion of the linkage between the ocean and the land. We're involving a bigger group here with the human dimensions aspect, and actually I think the big addition here is more of the mechanisms that are going in, because greening of the Arctic is really focusing on the spatial issues. Where is greening occurring and how is that linked to sea ice changes and climate?
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like the mechanisms behind these changes really need, that's what's new here.
Yes.
And that should be the focus, I think, of what's going on here. You know, although there's certainly elements related to spatial change that we probably aren't addressing in the Greening of the Arctic Initiative, it seems like the mechanisms really need to be the focus.
Yeah, I'll try to pull that out more, because that certainly was that's certainly the way I've been thinking about it, is that there are people doing, like you and some people that have been doing work on the patterns, and what's new is understanding mechanisms, understanding impacts in a more human impacts in perhaps a more elaborate way. So I'll work on pulling that out some more. Any final comments before we all say bye-bye? All right, then.
Sorry, this is Steve. I didn't get my hand up in time.
Hi, Steve.
Just one last comment, and I was kind of looking through the list of participants again. And
sure.
This continues to be, I think, a real need to recruit some marine people, some oceanographic people.
Yes.
To this group, if you're going to truly make it a kind of a cross-disciplinary one, as
opposed to simply a
request for oceanographic tame oceanographers to have input into what's fundamentally a terrestrial program.
Yeah. So if people have suggestions for marine folks who might be interested in participating, please email them to me because I would love to get some folks on board. Well, I want to thank you all very much again, and please email me any thoughts you have after we all hang up, and I will keep everybody posted and hopefully have a revised document to email around to you within the next week or so. So thank you all very much.
Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye.
All right.